Hello, I'm Jamie Sanchez, and I'll make monkeys of you.
And I'm Lauren Fates, and Faye Valentine is the reason I wing my eyeliner.
Are you ready for the beat?
I'm ready for the beat. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another week of the Bebop Beat. We're so glad to have you back, all 300,000 bounty hunters in the star system. We are super excited this week because we have our first ever in-the-studio guest. That's right. Last week was pre-recorded. I don't know if we fooled you or not. I thought it sounded pretty good. But someone's actually with us today, and we are so excited. Jamie, tell us all about her.
I would love to introduce to you Lauren Orsini, founder of Gunpla101.com, and a fandom reporter focusing on anime and manga with bylines in Anime News Network and Forbes. We're really excited to have you here today, Lauren.
I'm really excited to be here.
Two of three people in the room today are named Lauren, so this is going to be an adventure. I am Lauren F. Maybe we can go about it that way. But I am stoked. Jamie, how long have you known our guest? How long have you been a fan?
Oh, I'd have to say at least 3 or 4 years. So I was so happy to find an opportunity to connect with Lauren and see, especially that since this episode's so mechanical design forward, I thought maybe she would be interested. So I'm glad we could connect.
Well, you were right. I'm super interested.
Yes.
And I'm glad to be part of the Lauren majority.
The Lauren majority. If we vote on anything, we vote as one. Lauren, how long have you been into Cowboy Bebop? Are you a lifelong fan?
Oh my goodness. What's interesting about Cowboy Bebop is I'm 34, and back when I got into anime, it was already one of those shows you were supposed to know about, like an instant classic, a must watch. Which really says something.
We would agree. That's why we're doing this show. What drives you to anime in general? Why do you like this form of media?
Well, I got into anime because it was different from everything else airing on TV. And now I think it's that difference, that variety, that's what makes anime special even now. Like, I remember Miles, who works for Crunchyroll, saying that anime is the only medium he could think of in which fans are just constantly getting excited for new IPs on a quarterly basis. Instead of just remake after remake, anime fans are regularly tuning in to new stories. And yeah, we're talking about a really old, iconic one, but Cowboy Bebop is a new story for some anime fans who just got into it. I believe me.
Yeah, I get you when you say that, like, the quarterly fandom aspect of it, you know, it has a new kind of energy to it that we don't normally see in Western media. So it's nice to have the anticipation of, like, spring season coming up. Like, I know I'm really hyped for it.
Mm-hmm. It really shows how open-minded our fandom can be.
Definitely.
So you have been in the anime sphere writing for a super long time. Tell us just a little bit about your career right now. What is it like being a journalist? What are you up to?
I mean, this is a loaded question for me in 2021 because, like so many people, I've completely upended my life and, more importantly, my career in ways I never expected. So right now, I'm a full-time mom. I'm also just watching 10 anime and managing my Gunpla site. Otaku Journalist is my dormant blog about my dormant career. But, you know, that philosophy about niche storytelling is something that I still feel strongly about, even though I'm not writing regularly right now. Believe me, I'll definitely be back into it when life returns to normal.
Yeah, I don't know what that looks like, but at the same time, I totally get it, especially being a parent this time. Oh man, I couldn't imagine that.
I'm very taken by the fact that you mentioned anime fans get to see new stories all the time, but one of the key sort of pins that is stuck in our podcast is the fact that a Cowboy Bebop reboot is coming. They are doing this story again. So why do you think, or why not, do you think now is the time to do this? What still holds up about Cowboy Bebop?
Oh my goodness. When I was thinking about this, when I was rewatching Gateway Shuffle, I was thinking about how Cowboy Bebop is actually extremely relevant for what we're all going through right now. you know, it's just a group of gig economy workers in basically isolation, tripping all over each other in their spaceship, driving each other insane. That explains, that describes my house right now.
It describes a lot of families.
It's interesting you bring that up because in the course of my research for this episode, I found out that this particular episode, Gateway Shuffle, premiered on Adult Swim the week prior to 9/11. And it has some themes in it, too, that are kind of tangential to, like, okay, there's a, you know, people, society, there's a lot of concerns going on right now, a global concern. And I'd like to dive into that a little bit more. But, yeah, it's just wild how the show keeps its relevance even throughout the decades.
I don't think you'd have a podcast about it in 2021 if it weren't still so significant. Like, it has a near-perfect rating on Anime Planet.
Jamie, you were mentioning when this episode, Gateway Shuffle, was first released, and something we talk about often on this show is our first time seeing Cowboy Bebop, or what culturally was going on when Cowboy Bebop was airing. And we took note that Adult Swim also had, and Toonami also had Gundam Wing, which Lauren was billed to me as a Gundam fan. And I was just really curious if the people watching those shows were actually the same people. You know, they're billed in these animation blocks like you're going to sit and watch all of these cartoons. But in terms of Japanese culture, these anime aren't really in the same category, right?
Well, you'd be surprised at how many connections there are between Cowboy Bebop and the Gundam multiverse. I mean, the biggest one, and I'm guessing this is the reason you have me on the show, is because the mechanical designer, Kimitoshi Yamane, was the same mechanical designer for two of the most iconic Gundam series, O8th MS Team and Mobile Fighter G Gundam. In fact, I was looking at the timeline, and I think that he was designing the mecha for O8th MS Team at the same time that he was working on Cowboy Bebop.
Oh, wow, that's wild.
So the second one I mentioned, Mobile Fighter G Gundam, now that's a pretty odd-looking one. Some of the mobile suits are really out there. Just by the names, I'm going to say. Mermaid Gundam, Lumberjack Gundam,
yes!
Tequila Gundam.
Tequila Gundam!
Windmill Gundam.
Tag yourself, I'm Tequila Gundam.
Yeah, so if you think that Spike's Swordfish 2 or Faye's Red Tail and the others are really neat, and you haven't checked out Gundam, you might want to check out some of the Gundam series I just mentioned, because they have the same mechanical designer.
So I want to take a pause and let Jamie school us for a second, because I grew up knowing the terms shoujo and shonen, but you mentioned another one to me that I had not heard of, because this was not my cup of tea. Would you explain that for the listeners at home?
So there's another subgenre of anime known as seinen anime, S-E-I-N-E-N, and it is a genre that's geared towards typically a male crowd in Japan. We're talking late high school, college, young adulthood, right before the time where it's unacceptable for older adults in Japan to be into anime, and they switch to manga. Seinen anime typically is the stuff you would find on the Adult Swim's programming block or early Toonami stuff before they actually kind of got into more of the seedy, dark versions of anime. You often see overlaps with shonen, but shonen tends to be more lighthearted, geared towards younger male audiences, typically even kids sometimes. But yeah, I personally love seinen genres. It's funny because in Western audiences, I actually know a lot of women who enjoy seinen anime as well.
Yeah, Jamie, I'm glad for the intro because I find that one really tricky. Because I'm like, what is a seinen anime? Sometimes they're about high schoolers, sometimes they're about women and girls. It's like, what it basically seems to me is that if it ran in a seinen magazine or in a seinen programming block, that's how you know?
Yeah, it's a really strange classification because I'm personally a fan of action. I like buddy cop films and just like really fun stuff that might be considered more masculine or male forward. And I just think it's kind of silly that you would prohibit your marketing dollars, you know, and just kind of allocate it to only a male audience when there's an opportunity to, you know, double the size of your viewing audience.
That's the situation with Gundam too. Today we think of Gundam as something that has more men who are interested in it. But Yoshiyuki Tomino, the grandfather of Gundam, I mean, the guy who directed the very first Mobile Suit Gundam, said he owed it all to his female fans for popularizing it and for telling people about it.
Oh, that's wild. I had no idea. Like, and I know there's a fair number of female Gundam fans out there too, but you would think in a market here, at least in the West, there, it doesn't give a lot of exposure, unfortunately. It's always framed as like, oh, this is like Legos or, you know, other more gendered toys that are more STEM related. So I never really see, you know, Gundam in the framework of like, oh, this is, it has a heavy female audience. It attributes its success to it.
Isn't that always the way, though? Famously, Star Trek was really popularized by the efforts of women. And for whatever reason, the reason is sexism. Grown men are trying to, like, put boundaries around sci-fi and gatekeep it as if women and housewives watching TV at home weren't there all along. It always seems to actually be the ladies doing the work, just saying.
Star Trek is such a great example because, you know, the first anime music video was a Star Trek anime music video, and it was a woman who created it. And back then, I mean, you couldn't do digital editing. She actually picked up actual film from the cutting room floor and
chopping
made her AMV
film
that way, which is super hardcore.
Stop my heart.
Oh my god, speaking of AMVs, I can't go on a Cowboy Bebop podcast without mentioning this AMV that was like the way I got into anime music videos was seeing one called Tainted Donuts. It was,
yes!
A crossover.
I knew you were going to say Tainted Donuts.
I knew
the moment you started talking. I was like, please let this be what this is about. Thank goodness, praise Tainted Donuts.
I was in ninth grade. Maybe I was in 10th grade. You know, it,
wow.
And I found this online to the song Shiroi Nami Nonaka. And, you know, it's Spike and Jed are trying to catch Vash the Stampede. And at the time, it was really hard to do that kind of video editing.
Yeah.
It's so hard to believe, doing this podcast right now, that Cowboy Bebop is 23 years old.
I have the 20th anniversary edition from Funimation sitting in my collection, and I just opened it up, and I was like, big 20 on there. I'm like, no, it's aging me.
So, Lauren, how did watching this show today differ from watching it decades ago?
Okay, so, you know, I just rewatched Gateway Shuffle yesterday in preparation for the podcast, and I was thinking while I was watching it that a lot of the time when I'm recommending old anime to people, even like old Gundam, I tell them to adjust their expectations, to expect things to move a little more slowly. But this episode, which I don't even think is one of the show's best episodes, has a really quick pace and has comedic timing that still feels very fresh today.
Would this be an episode you would recommend to others? Like, if they were to just be like, oh, taste a Cowboy Bebop.
You didn't ask me, but I'm saying no. Okay, now you answer.
Okay, so I actually was looking it up because I'm like, this is a very cookie cutter bounty of the week episode. And it turns out it made comicbookreader.com's top 4 worst episodes of Cowboy Bebop.
That's harsh.
When I was Googling just what do people think of this, the first video on YouTube is called In Defense of Gateway Shuffle because people dislike it enough that that video needed to be made.
How about that? I mean, the thing is, and I really related to this, is that they could have really tapped in further to making, what's her name, Twinkle, a more multidimensional character. But it's really just good versus bad. We could talk a lot about how it's environmentalists who are the bad guys.
This is clearly an analogy to PETA in so many ways. I don't know who had a beef with PETA, but this was definitely the episode they took the aggression out on.
Yeah, I think we'll get more into this later, but I think it's important that part of the narrative is this used to be an organization that was doing a lot of good, and it used to be a gentler, more pacifistic group. And then Twinkle's rise to power, a lot of the old members quit, and it became something else. So I guess we're getting into it just formally. Here we go. This is Gateway Shuffle. This is the story of a... It starts, they start by chasing one bounty and end up finding another. And the story is actually pretty simple, as wild and crazy as it is. And it starts with Jet and Spike in a restaurant. I actually, even though it's exposition heavy, I really enjoy this scene because they talk a little bit about the history of the galaxy. And there was a food scarcity issue before the gateways all opened up. And the economy and the stability of being able to feed people kind of evened out once that technology was available to everybody. And the food they're talking about is the Ganymede Sea Rat, and the Space Warriors, these self-described eco-soldiers, their only goal is protecting the Ganymede Sea Rat. I noticed that they still eat pork, so they're a little bit hypocritical from the jump.
So a lot of what we hit on these first episodes were the backgrounds, the settings for the story, right? And here we're introduced to Ganymede, which is a moon of Jupiter. Really, science is telling us that it probably has oxygen or oxygen light, maybe a saltwater ocean beneath its crust. So the idea that, you know, the Cowboy Bebop world could terraform this moon is feasible. And we see all of the settings, like this really beautiful blue ocean look, and all these things are docked on the side. Unfortunately, this world doesn't have a lot to add, like in terms of graffiti and motion and things like that, beyond the restaurant itself. A lot of the action takes place on all the ships throughout the series. So, yeah, I don't know. I wish Ganymede had more of a personality.
Yeah, we also see a lot of, you know, we see the backgrounds of just cookie cutter space. And that's actually aged the worst, that kind of CGI rendering of planets.
Yeah, and the hyperspace texture.
Yeah, you can tell it's old there, and maybe a little in hyperspace too.
Definitely the sort of lights shooting into the center of the gate has a very old CGI vibe. A running theme that goes through Cowboy Bebop that we've talked about already is that this crew is pretty constantly broke, out of food, down on their luck. And Faye ends up wrapped up in this conflict because even though she's not an official crew member yet, she's stuck out in space. She's eating the like emergency rations on her ship. And she happens to find this man whose ship is blown up. He's dying. Photos of his family are floating around him. And he gives her a case. He says, take this to the ISSP, but don't open it. Of course, Faye's very tempted. She tries to open it, and it is the item that brings her back into the fray with the crew of the Bebop. The main question that I had within the first, like, 3 minutes of this episode is the terrorist group kills just everyone in the restaurant. And it's because another man orders the sea rat. What if it had been Spike? Would that have been the end of the show? And why were they the only, they're literally the only survivors. Was it just plot armor?
You get the impression that they're maybe seasoned in gunfights because they have the wherewithal to jump behind a table, even though Spike really wants his beverage and tries to sneak it off the table.
That was such a great beat of comedy.
Truly. I also appreciate Jet's, when he's using the glasses to figure out if Morgan is the target that they believe he is. And he says, quote, "Do that morphin for my endorphin."
Definitely a dub only joke. Speaking of that technology, that is one of the things that I did not catch until this current watch through of Bebop, because the implication of those glasses is that plastic surgery is actually really common, especially in these people running from the law. So that was a huge plot point in Stray Dog Strut, and it wasn't a fundamental key plot point this time, but it was there again. Like, you can change your whole face pretty easily in this universe, I guess. It must not even cost that much.
And your skin tone for your entire body.
Yeah, yeah. Being able to, I'm not going to open this can of worms right now, but the frequency with which these characters change race has some really iffy implications about just racism in this universe. You know, part of the reason in 2021, the main reason blackface is not okay is because a race is not a costume. And what people say rightly is you can take off the uniform from your job, you can take off cosmetics, but you're never able to take off your race. And in this universe, you can. And I kind of wish that had come up. The reason I bring it up is to say it never comes up in this show. They never mention it as a unique and terrifying societal implication. But racial, like, relations, it has to be an entirely different thing in this universe.
Maybe he's like a cyborg? I mean, it makes me think of the Cyberpunk 2077 character design. Like, you know, where you pick your avatar and you can make yourself pink or purple.
I haven't played it, but I know what you mean. And you're right. It's actually a more common trope than...
It's like, ooh, it's the future. You can look however. And then you can change it tomorrow.
That's even a little problematic in and of itself to be like, you could be purple, just like you could be an actual race.
So if we're talking about uncomfortable decisions right now, the fandom in particular has been up in arms about how the quote Netflix casting isn't good. I see this constantly on Facebook groups. And the most prominent choice is Mustafa Shakir, who's playing Jet Black. So I don't necessarily want to dig into what the fandom intends. Like, is this the right casting choice or not? But at the same time, like, I personally think that Black representation in the main cast of Cowboy Bebop would be, you know, it's smart. It's good. I like it. I like this change. Put that on record, please.
I think that makes sense for an American audience, too. Imagine having a white character named Jet Black.
And, I mean, Bo Billingsley, he himself is Black. So, as the voice actor of Jet in the English dub, for those who do not know.
Yeah, it's really bizarre to know about Bo Billingsley and his talent and his contributions to this show and then have a problem with this.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Also, it has nothing to do with the story. I mean, the point that I was kind of trying to make is how strikingly absent the conversation is from the show, even as we're watching people change the color of their skin. So if it's going to be such a non-issue in this universe, then who even cares? Yeah. Like, please cast more diversely, because we've already said canonically it doesn't matter.
Oh, I have not been looking into fan reactions to the casting, and now I'm really happy that I haven't.
That reminds me that, Lauren, you brought up in our initial invite email about Huskygate and everything that happened with it. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So, basically, you're familiar with the Netflix adaptation meme, where they go, this is the original version of something, and then this is the Netflix version of something, and it's supposed to be, like, second rate, because the joke is that Netflix
doesn't... It's gonna be bad!
Yeah,
we haven't seen it, but we already know!
Yeah, so a I don't know if it was a parody site or just some people who wanted some attention, but they put up an article, maybe a blog post, that said, oh, by the way, in the Cowboy Bebop Netflix adaptation, Ein is going to be played by a husky. And people just, it immediately went viral. Everyone was sharing that because it immediately made them mad. Doesn't it just make you angry to think that Netflix would just suddenly cast a husky in this iconic role?
It doesn't make me mad, but I could see someone being mad. I could see someone having that opinion, especially a corgi owner like Jamie.
I think it's time for changes. I'm okay with Netflix doing something different, so long as it contributes to the success and interest of the show.
that is true. I was talking about how great it is that anime has variety, and then we also have these factions that are like, we have to create the same IP over and over, and that's not great either. Okay, but the thing is, I was trying to explain this when I said I was going to be on a podcast and I was going to mention Huskygate. Someone's like, what's Huskygate? I'm like, you know, where they said that a husky was going to play Ein in the Netflix adaptation. And people are immediately start yelling at me, what? They're going to do that? Basically, it's believable. Even without any evidence, without doing any of your homework, just the idea that Netflix might do that, because some Netflix adaptations in the past have been very different or have been very unpopular.
And you also mentioned that it wasn't just the fandom that reacted to this, incorrect material. It was also bloggers, correct?
It seemed to be picked up by, the larger media sphere, like anyone who talks about Hollywood. So I can completely understand why people fell for this, because it is really juicy. It seems very newsworthy and timely, but of course the evidence isn't behind it. It actually got so big that Netflix itself had to debunk it on the Netflix Twitter. Christopher Yost, the director, even had to say that Ein has always been a corgi, never a husky, on his official Twitter. Because this just got out so out of control so quickly. It's very tempting to pick these things up. And, I mean, we know that social media has altered the way that our brains work, and we're more likely to share things that make us angry, that give us negative emotions in some way. So, as irritating as I find that little Twitter thing, that little Twitter warning where they're like, read the article first, have you read it before retweeting it? Like, for example, I get that warning on things I've written myself. Like, would you like to read the article before you retweet it? I wrote it.
I am the article.
I mean, their heart's in the right place, if Twitter can be said to have anything left in their shriveled husk that is a heart. That might be a heart.
I love the internet. All of my small amount of fandom success that I can lay claim to has been because the internet exists. But the current era of fandom quote-unquote journalism is extremely frustrating to me, because there's a trend, at least right now, to make news out of opinions. And you see it especially for like casting announcements. And it definitely happened with Cowboy Bebop to a smaller degree. I really saw it happening with The Last of Us. You know, who's going to play Joel? Who's going to play Ellie? The fandom wants so-and-so. The fandom wants so-and-so. The second Gina Carano was fired from Star Wars, it was the fans want Lucy Lawless. And I'm like, this isn't news. Saying that some people had opinions, it's exactly as you say. It's there to just rile people up and pull aggro from people who don't agree and get those shares and those clicks from people with different negative dissenting opinions. And it's
works.
Harder and harder to, it works. It works. People eat it up, and it's harder and harder to find actual news. You know, Jamie and I really try to find updates about the Netflix show. And I think we actually have one this week to share, but you gotta wade through a bunch of opinion framed as news before you can just find actual, official, credible stuff.
Yeah, because there's just not enough news to go around. And if you're a journalist who has to publish a certain number of times a day, you're going to check the hashtag and you're going to see what people are talking about, what the buzz is. I mean, we can't really blame this on individual journalists. Maybe we should blame it on, like, the money-making model. It's a lot more profitable to publish more often, even if it's not always fact.
It's profitable, and immediate satisfaction has become the expectation. Sort of a tangential thing to compare it to is how I've seen folks complaining that WandaVision is too slow, and it only feels slow because it's actually being released weekly like television used to be. But we don't operate that way anymore. We want the whole story right now. And I actually really miss the era when I was watching anime 1 week at a time on Cartoon Network and just wondering what was going to happen next or tomorrow, you know, what's going to... Honestly, now that I think about it, releasing certain anime day by day or week by week, I don't think, like, a Dragon Ball, for example, would work if you released it all at once, because the whole crux of, like, Dragon Ball Z was the cliffhanger of how the fight was going to turn tomorrow. And they would drag that out for so long, like suddenly Frieza has another form. And if you didn't have to wait till the next episode, that tension is useless. You can't do it anymore.
Yeah, I love that we are able to watch anime as simulcasts these days, and you can just talk about it all season as it comes out week by week. Meanwhile, a Netflix show will come out all at once. They'll hold that anime until it's all ready, then it'll all come out, we'll all talk about that anime for like 2 days, and then move on.
There was word that Netflix Japan would be experimenting with episodic releases, mostly to follow the anime premiere schedule over there. And I wonder if that's actually going to be something that's seriously considered here, especially when we're talking about, you know, Netflix dumping more money into new anime in general and it being a big moneymaker for them.
So, Jamie, you did have news about the release of the Netflix show. Did that news include whether or not it was dropping all at once?
It did not. So the news says that the show will conclude soon. So filming of the show will conclude soon, and that release will be end of summer, presumably around August. This is from an interview via Instagram of Mustafa Shakir and Instagram account Roots of Light. But that's all I have to add on that one. This is thanks to the Reddit thread that was posted 3 days ago.
3 days ago at the time of this recording.
Correct.
So we might not even be through the anime. I was hoping we'd be through it by the time Netflix was popping, but let's hurry.
I guess you could just watch all of it at once instead of watching it week by week.
Well, or you could do the Adult Swim thing, which it aired 2 episodes at a time. I forgot about that completely. That was some nighttime watching. I should have been in bed, but I was watching Cowboy Bebop at like 10:30 at night.
I can remember an age where it was a special treat that I could stay up after 9. There was a show on MTV called Buzzkill, and once a week my parents would let me stay up after 9 to watch the prank show Buzzkill. And now I don't even think about bed at 9. If I can be asleep before midnight, it is a gift. Adulthood is weird.
So I guess we're all of the age where we first saw Cowboy Bebop on Toonami. I hope that people who are listening to this podcast, some of them have seen it more recently than that. Like, they were introduced to it later on. Or maybe they're younger and they just got into anime and they're like, what should I watch? Because every time there's one of those lists online, like, okay, I just got into anime, what should I watch? Everyone says Cowboy Bebop.
It's really funny because my partner's brother-in-law, I told him about this show and that we're doing a podcast about it, and he would be the last person I'd ever consider to watch anime. And we got to the first 5 minutes and he was riveted. So I'm like super excited that, you know, someone who would never be an anime fan actually resonated like with the show in the first 5 minutes 23 years later.
Yeah, I know people my age who are like, I'm not an anime fan, but Cowboy Bebop is great. And I would like to know if, like, the youths are watching it.
I think we're going to have a thumb on that as this podcast actually starts to air. The people I've been seeing on Instagram, they seem younger. I just have a feeling that they are. The bounty this episode is Twinkle Maria Murdoch. She's worth $25 million. And this is just a real character. She sings in an operatic tone. She's dancing in gunfire. And she has this unsettling relationship with her colleagues. I don't know if they're actually her sons, but she treats them like they are. And our crew actually manages to catch her. They don't get to keep her. Because shortly after she's on the Bebop, the bounty disappears. Ganymede no longer wants her, and Spike and Jet can't figure out why. It turns out they're not just your run-of-the-mill eco-protesters. They have this virus that will transform men into monkeys. The science presented in this episode says that there is just a 2% DNA difference between humans and monkeys, and this virus acts on that 2%, genetically warping dudes into terrifying, screaming chimp beings. I did a little dive into this. I just wanted to know if that was real or if that was grounded in anything. There is a much larger DNA difference between humans and monkeys. However, humans and chimpanzees, humans and bonobos, we have somewhere between 96 and 99% DNA that we share with those great apes. So this episode plays a little fast and loose with saying monkey and ape, and as if they're the same thing. They're not. But this episode got it closer than I thought.
I mean, to be clear, that could never happen, but...
Right.
Science fiction! That's why I love this show. It really goes off the deep end when it wants to.
But I guess that's what makes for good science fiction, when it is rooted a little bit in the truth.
Yeah, they tried to plant a seed of truth somewhere. And they really vamped on it. They really went off the rails from there. But it started somewhere real. It is science fiction, after all.
I will say that this episode, especially the chase scene where the virus is on the loose, so to speak, it reminded me of an anime anthology film called Memories. Akira's director, Katsuhiro Otomo, was the executive producer of this. And in particular, I'm talking about the short called Stink Bomb, in which an individual has been exposed to some kind of virus or genetic mutation, and he admits it stinks so bad that he kills everybody in his presence as he wanders towards the center of the city. And it just has the same kind of vibe to me, the same kind of real tension building.
It's horrifying and gross, but also kind of funny.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a story that was actually written after a real life death of a woman known as Gloria Ramirez, or the Toxic Lady. And so this idea that there's, you know, sci-fi elements out there where a virus can come and genetically alter someone and really uproot everybody by some supernatural means, that's not something in particular to this episode. It's just, I also believe it's prevalent in a lot of sci-fi, too.
Oh, man. Virus stuff really hits different right now, though.
Oh, it truly does. And that's what I...
It does.
It's like, they're going to lock it into hyperspace. I'm like, good, do that.
Can we do that?
Because otherwise, it's going to spread through the entire planet. another thing that really hit different, to your point, is politicians. There's a big difference between the dub and the sub that I found just fascinating. The dub makes the politicians just a little bit more crooked than the sub. I don't know if either of you noticed this, but the way I interpreted this is that in the sub, Twinkle makes this demand that she wants an end to the harvesting of the sea rats. And Ganymede says, we're thinking about it. We will work on it.
Yes.
And then she ends up firing missiles on them because what they land on is we will limit the harvesting, and that's not good enough. The tweak in the dub is that they flat out tell the terrorists at first that they are putting an end to harvesting. They confirm, we are passing this law, we're passing this rule. And then once the threat is seemingly neutralized, they go back on their promise. They say, no, actually, we're only going to limit harvesting. So the dub version shows the politicians going back on a promise, whereas in the sub, it just kind of takes them too long and they don't do a good enough job. And I love that twist. I think it's better. I think it's better this way than the dub way. So the politicians botch it, and the terrorist group decides, all right, we're turning all of Ganymede into monkeys. And this is where we get the gateway shuffle, if you will, in that Spike and Faye have to try and stop the virus missiles before they rain down on the moon below. One of my favorite moments in this episode is Faye negotiating with the boys as to whether or not she's actually going to come in and help in this situation. They have her captive for a while. This is the episode where we get that iconic Faye picture that's on all the t-shirts of her handcuffed above her head, looking real foxy. She gets out and she wants a piece of the action. She wants a majority share of the bounty just to stop this terrible thing from happening to Ganymede. And they let her have it. She gets her way, and I'm really impressed by her in this moment, even if it's because she's kind of a sociopath.
There's a scene that just sticks out to me. There's that extremely tense scene where they're interrogating, where Jet is interrogating the chief of police and trying to figure out where the bounty has gone, while Spike is just casually, nonchalantly shooting up the virus, while Twinkle Maria is trying not to sweat. She's just trying to play it cool, and she's wondering if she should speak up and say something because he's about to, like, let this virus loose. And my read on it is he totally knows what he's doing. See, and that's why he slips it into her pocket.
We've had this conversation, Lauren and I, about whether Spike is or is not in control of the situation as much as we think he is as the audience. So it's good to hear your take.
I put that in my notes, and I'm so glad you brought it up, because I really took the stance last episode that he is supernaturally lucky and he isn't always aware of what he's doing, but one of his sort of powers is that he just manages to get by based on how little he cares. But I think this episode sells it the other way. I think this episode makes a really strong case that Spike is in control and he does actually know better.
Yeah, perhaps at first he didn't know what he was doing, but I mean, her eye was twitching as he's trying to brute force this virus.
To be fair, I think he would have done it either way. His answer is his feet and his guns. So if he can't solve it one way, he's going to solve it the other.
I think my favorite scene in this episode, unfortunately, also has some real different relevance today. And it is when Jet calls out his own ISSP comrade on being corrupt. He wants help, he's not getting it, and he points out that while he was working with his buddy, a bunch of, like, drugs, a bunch of eye drops went missing. Confiscated drugs were being stolen by the cops. And it just really makes it clear that, you know, one bad apple spoils the bunch. You hear so often people saying, like, many cops are good, but there's just a few bad apples. The whole point of the idea of bad apples is that as long as they're in the bunch, the whole system is ruined. And I think we're supposed to believe that Jet is a good guy. Jet's a good cop. He's a good man overall. But he was still complicit in the past when his friend was corrupt. And he knows that his friend was corrupt and let him get away with it. So it doesn't even matter necessarily that he was a good man. And I think it's easy to pass up that scene, especially when I was a younger woman and didn't really understand all that it implied. But it's big. It's like a big revelation about policing.
What's more is they add the nudie mags to Bob's. Like, this is our first introduction to Bob, and he's just this really pervy perv.
They kind of bring it back around, too, with the button of the episode. Like, Faye goes to take a shower, and Spike's like, she's in our shower, I'm gonna go stop her. And Jet doesn't stop her, and there's this moment of, like, yeah, she's literally shooting at you because you were being a perv. Like, don't be a perv is a running theme in this one for some reason, just in the background.
Yeah, everyone in the show is a little rough around the edges. And I'm trying to decide if that's something that's happened with age or that's always been the implication here, that nobody's perfect, that people have had to take up these maladaptive measures in order to survive in this universe.
Yeah, I think a lot of that stuff has always been there, but our lack of life experience previously maybe didn't see it. Because another thing I caught this episode was the fact that Faye spent all of the money that she had gotten earlier in the show and was already broke again. She had a chance to pay off a little bit of debt, like fix up her life a little bit, and she bought a pile of nice clothes instead. And I think there's a real sad message in there, too. It's the nature of astronomical debt and being burdened by such a tremendous dollar amount over your head that paying a little bit of it off doesn't necessarily even feel worthwhile. You might as well just spend it and be happy. That's dark, but it's been there all along.
Yeah, I said at the beginning that I was thinking about them as gig economy workers, and that actually is not an idea I originally came up with. I got that from a Vulture article published in December, written by Mariah Kruder, because it just makes a fascinating case for how, you know, Spike and Jet and Faye, they never get paid, they still have to work, with the promise of maybe getting paid later. Which never or rarely happens.
So do you think money is the reason Faye stayed?
That's a great question.
I don't think so. I think she is tired of being on her own. It's clear that she wants more space than her tiny little ship has to offer. And I guess a little bit of it, too, is maybe it's fate that she ran into them a second time. And they kind of had to save her, so to speak. So she's leaning into it. Good for her.
I feel like you'd say good for her no matter what Faye did. It's like she negotiated to save the lives of everyone on Ganymede, but only if she could have a majority of the money. Good for her.
This is really her episode.
Well, it's good for her. It's good for her in that, like, Bluth meme sort of way. Like, good for her. Ayn's role is already minimized. We have talked a couple of times on our short podcast about how Ayn is a data dog, and then the writers forgot about that. And Ayn is in, like, two scenes this time, growling at Faye, and Faye growling back. And that's it. That's all he gets to do. You would think they would utilize him more to hunt bounties. Oh, well.
Just a smart dog with short legs. I think the real comedy comes from the fact that they don't show what happens after the growling, and then we just see that Faye is free. Leaves it up to your imagination.
The last cool science in this episode is the idea that matter enclosed in hyperspace cannot interact with this plane, but can still be seen. And that's just pure sci-fi, because that sort of scientific conclusion, we really haven't figured it out to that degree as a human race yet. So that's just a cool thing that they made up.
I want to say that scene is a triple threat. One, that would be my cool factor. The idea that things can get enclosed in hyperspace and they're no longer part of this reality, but they're somehow still visible, like particles can still hit your eye some way. Cool. All right, I'm leaning into that. But then there's this really great look on Faye's face when she's literally scared out of her mind. She's like clenching her head, and it's got the really comical 90s anime face going on, which I appreciate because you don't see enough of that anymore in anime. And then on top of that, it's also after this really intense scene where, you know, they're trying to push their way through hyperspace before they're enclosed and lost forever. So there's just this really nice comedic button there. And I think that's a triple threat.
I'm just really grateful for the genre of sci-fi. Again, kind of as we were talking earlier about its historical significance, if you go online and try to look into hyperspace theory and try to see what science has guessed about this so far, half the articles are couched in like Star Wars and the Millennium Falcon, because this type of popular media is what makes common people care about concepts like this. Like, I saw a really cool idea on Star Wars. Now I want to know if it can actually happen. I think a lot of young people, maybe even ourselves included, have gotten excited about science and learning and what there is to know about the universe because we saw stuff like this. And I don't know if we realized that's what was happening at the time, but I believe that it's true right now.
So before we wrap up today, Lauren, I wanted Laurens, plural. We have two Laurens today.
We are Legion.
I wanted to touch a little bit on production. So this last episode was written by Sadayuki Murai, also known for writing Boogie Woogie Feng Shui and Parole de Fou. More recently, Sadayuki wrote Knights of Sidonia for Netflix in 2014. Also, Kino's Journey in 2003. But most notably wrote the screenplays for Satoshi Kon's Millennium Actress and Perfect Blue. So if you haven't seen those films yet, those are great films to be watching.
My last catch this episode is all the way back from the beginning. I went way out of order to pull this, but I wanted to save it for last. I'm the person that pauses these episodes and tries to read things that are on signs and on labels. And one of Faye's rations is a chocolate bar that is manufactured at Milk Products LLC in Chicago, Illinois, Ooh. Japan. No, but Chicago, Illinois, Japan.
I'm for what? It. What?
Things really changed in their century.
Yeah, I was trying to hypothesize, like, was a city and a state called Chicago, Illinois, founded in Japan? Or is Japan just everything now? What happened?
There is a consignment chain in Japan called Chicago, and that always trips me up.
Maybe it's consignment store chocolate. That's weird.
Well, Lauren, since we had you here today, I really want to thank you so much for agreeing to the interview. Did you have anything else you wanted to share with us regarding your journeys as a journalist or your thoughts on the anime sphere today?
Well, I purposely haven't been following along with news about the Netflix adaptation, but just being on this podcast has made me a lot more excited for it. And thank you for spreading that enthusiasm to me.
Aw, thank you.
That made me smile so big. Thanks. If our listeners wanted to find some of your work or connect with you in a way that you would enjoy, where should they look?
Definitely check out my blog, Gunpla101.com, where I teach people how to build model kits. By the way, there are, in fact, several Cowboy Bebop model kits, though none of them are currently in stock right now. I looked them up. Most of them are of the swordfish.
I believe Lauren is currently painting Julia's hair still. How's that coming along?
Oh, yeah. I got a second unpainted Julia figure sent to me from the Netherlands because the first one's face ended up in my dog's mouth. And so now I can finally finish it because there's a face I can paint. The rest of it looks really great. Thanks for asking.
Oh, Doggo.
I'm excited to see how that turns out.
We will put it on our Instagram. All right, well, that about wraps up the Bebop Beat for this week. Next time, we are going to talk Ballad of Fallen Angels with our friends from Reddit. So if you are listening to this, maybe check out the Cowboy Bebop subreddit or the related Discord, and you'll be ready to hang out with us next week.
Goodbye.
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 I'll turn you all into monkeys.
Thank you for listening to the Bebop Beat. If you like our show, please rate us on Apple or wherever you find your podcasts. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bebop Beat. Our email address is bebopbeatpodcast@gmail.com.
The Bebop Beat is hosted and produced by Jamie Sanchez and Lauren Fates. Our editor and associate producer is Angela Geis. Our logo and art assets are by Kat Janda. So, quick point here. This is, they missed two bounties this episode, so therefore we are 5 out of 5 fuck-ups.